Tura Dhamma Ki Jai, Navadvip Maya Pura Dhamma Ki Jai, Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki Jai, Gangamaya Jamuna Devi Ki Jai, Bhakti Devi Ki Jai, Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai, Samaveta Bhaktarinda Ki Jai, Gaur Premananda. All glorious to the assembled devotees. All glorious to the assembled devotees. All glorious to the assembled devotees. All glorious to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glorious to Srila Prabhupada. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasaya Bhutale Sri Mati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namani. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pachandi Namaste Sissini Hari Paskachandi Satayana Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Guru and Vaishnavam Cha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sagana Raghunatham Vitam Sam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Vita Sri Vishakam Vitam Cha Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. August 29th, 2019. Here in Inishrath, what do we call the
Govindadweep.
Govindadweep in Ireland. And we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 3. Krishna is the source of all incarnations, text 31. Yatana Vasi Megogro. Renurva partivo nile.
Renurva partivo nile.
Evam drastari drisyatvam.
Evam drastari drisyatvam.
Aropitam abudibhi.
Aropitam abudibhi.
Please chant. Yata. Oh, go ahead. Yata.
Yata.
As it is.
As it is.
Nabasi.
Nabasi.
In the sky.
In the sky.
Mega Ogha.
Mega Ogha.
A mass of clouds.
A mass of clouds.
That would be a nice one to teach kids, right? Your son's not here right now. Right? Mega Ogho. Mega Ogho. Isn't that cool? Yeah. Mega Ogha. Renu.
Renu.
I know, what does Renu mean? We have the Charana Renu. No? Renu means dust. Va.
Va.
As well as.
As well as.
Partivaha.
Partivaha.
Muddiness.
Muddiness.
Anile.
Anile.
In the air.
In the air.
Evam.
Evam.
Thus.
Thus.
Drastari.
Drastari.
To the seer.
To the seer.
Drist. Yatvam, for the purpose of seeing,
Aropitam,
is implied, Abudibhi, by the less intelligent persons. Translation. Clouds and dust are carried in the air, but less intelligent persons say that the sky is cloudy and the air is dusty. Similarly, they also implant material bodily conceptions on the spirit self. Purport. It is further confirmed herein that with our material eyes and senses, we cannot see the Lord, who is all spirit. We cannot even detect the spiritual spark which exists within the material body of the living being. We look to the outward covering of the body or the subtle mind of the living being, but we cannot see the spiritual spark within the body. So we have to accept the living being's presence by the presence of his gross body. Similarly, those who want to see the Lord with their present material eyes or with the material senses are advised to meditate on the gigantic external feature called the Virat Rupa. For instance, when a particular gentleman goes in his car, which can be seen very easily, we identify the car with the man within the car. When the president goes out in his particular car, we say, "There is the president." For the time being, we identify the car with the president. Similarly, less intelligent men who want to see God immediately, without necessary qualifications, are shown first the gigantic material cosmos as the form of the Lord, although the Lord is within and without. The clouds in the sky and the blue of the sky are better appreciated in this connection. Although the bluish tint of the sky and the sky itself are different, we conceive of the color of the sky as blue. But that is a general conception for the layman only. Yata nabasi megogo reinurva partivo nile evam drastari drist yat tum arupitam abudhi bihi. Clouds and dust are carried by the air, but less intelligent persons say that the sky is cloudy or the air is dirty. Similarly, they also implant material bodily conceptions on the spirit self. So here Prabhupada's picking up on this word, abudibihi, not very intelligent, and he's saying here that less intelligent men who want to see God immediately without necessary qualification. So we might read that and say, oh gosh, that's not me. Less intelligent people who want to see God without any necessary qualifications, that's not me at all. And so this has nothing to do with me. The first time that I attended a lecture by Srila Prabhupada was in Chicago in 1974. He'd come for our first Rath Yatra. And Srila Prabhupada was speaking about wanting to see God. And he said, you know, we're trying to see God, but we cannot even see the soul. Which is exactly the same thing Srila Prabhupada is saying here. He's saying that we want to see God, but we cannot even, he said, with our material eyes and senses, we cannot see the Lord, who is all spirit. We cannot even detect the spiritual spark which exists within the material body of a living being. So we're just conventionally, because your bodies are sitting here, I figure you're here. Prabhupada compares it to a car. We see a recognizable car. We know that car belongs to a particular person. And so we say, oh, that person has come, although we don't see them, we just see the car. Or, you know, a universally recognized person, the president, oh, there's the president. Although we don't, again, see the president, we just see the car. So, I'm sorry to say that, at least for myself, I must be in this category of a less intelligent person without necessary qualification, because when I'm looking at all of you, I don't see any of you at all. I just see your cars. You know, here's your cars parked in the parking lot. Car park. Do you say car park like the Brits? Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay, so I see your cars are parked in the car park, and I say, oh, you're here. There you are. But I don't see you at all. You know, I do a lot of flying in airplanes, and you get to a point where you can see the cars, but you have to practically land before you can see the people. You know, people are so, so small that until you're just, you know, a few meters above the ground, all you can see are the cars. So, yeah, this is a problem. And yet there's a solution. There's a solution. So here Prabhupada says we can deduce the presence of a soul from the existence of a functioning body and mind. We can also deduce the presence of God from the body of the universe. But Prabhupada's also hinting here that we shouldn't just be happy to stay at that level of qualification. You know, just to say, well, I'm an intelligent person without qualification. You know, that's a good place to start. It's a good place to start if that's where we are. But we don't want to stay where we are. So it is, of course, important to start where we are. Where else are you going to start from, one might say. One might say, well, that's an obvious and foolish statement, Ermila, which just further proves how unintelligent you are. But many of us, I think, try to start from where we're not. Yes? So I have a very dear friend who unfortunately lost her husband to this person who claims to be a guru, teaching how you can fall in love with Krishna by basically pretending to be in love with Krishna. Yeah? I mean, it did work for Putana to pretend to be a mother, but in general, that's not really the recommended process. And so they think of something in the material world that makes them cry, and then they start crying, and then they chant Hare Krishna while they're crying about, you know, burning the Amazon or something like that. So this is, people try to start from where they're not. It's a big problem. It's a really, really big problem. Right? I was just talking with Manu a little bit yesterday about how to build community. And I was saying, well, community is primarily the grihastha ashram. The brahmacharis, vanaprasthas, and sannyasis don't really build a community. And so if you want to build a community, you need to sit down with people when they're 25 at the latest and say, marry your renunciation now. You know, take your choice now at 25. Go one way or the other. He said, yeah, we have people at 47 getting married. You know, 67 maybe. Whatever, 77. So if people are waiting to 47 to get married, they're not starting where they are they? They're pretending to be something that they're not. They're like, you know, and I meet devotees like this all the time. I'm a renunciate. Well, that, no, you're not, because that's not what a renunciate is. A renunciate is like, I'm a renunciate. I'm a different thing. So it happens all the time. And I think, you know, it happens in the world that people pretend to be something that they're not. They pretend they know more than they know, or that they're better than they are. You know, our present U.S. president is a very good example of this. And it was a compilation of him saying, you know, no one loves the Bible more than I do. And it's like, okay. Nobody understands the military more than I do. And, you know, this whole list of things that he's the best at in the world, and you're thinking, I don't think so. So it's very common, I mean, he may be an extreme example, but it's very common that people try to start where they're not. And such a phenomenon happens also in ISKCON. Yeah? And we've seen it over and 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 over again, where we project an atmosphere of saintliness and purity, and then it turns out that really the situation is not quite exactly like that. Now, on a very practical level, one can't get anywhere unless you start where you are. If you want to give someone directions here to Govindadweep, the first thing you ask them is, where are you? Yeah? So we used to run a school in North Carolina, and this was before the days of Google Maps and things of that kind, and before the days of mobile phones. And my husband had written out directions how to get there if you were coming from the east and how to get there if you were coming from the west. So when people would call and say, we'd like to visit your school, how do I get there? We would pull out our handy-dandy pre-written instructions and say, again, where are you? Where are you coming from? And if we're not clear about where we're coming from, we will do something wrong. Yes? I will go straight where I should turn right, or I will turn left when I should go straight, because I'm giving the wrong starting point. So if all I'm seeing is the body and mind, if I'm not seeing the soul, then that's where I am. That's where I have to start from. And that's okay. It's actually fully okay to start from where we're at. You know, we can all kind of go, I can actually start from where I am. And this is one key. How do I know that I'm dealing with another living being? Well, they have a moving, animated body. And they have some indication of the presence of mind. I mean, just like in medical science, even if the heart's beating, if the brain is flat, they say that there's nobody there anymore. They call them their brain dead. Someone's absent. Yeah. Of course, sometimes they make mistakes with this kind of thing. Sometimes they make a mistake as to whether or not the person is there. And there's so many accounts of people who die and then come back to their body. They call them near-death experiences. And sometimes, by all accounts, the body and the mind appear not to be functional. Yeah? Anyway, this is a good place to start, and we can therefore say that any body that is exhibiting symptoms of moving, changing, we have the six changes, birth, growth, producing byproducts, staying, dwindling, and death. Any indication of desire, any indication of emotions, any indication of thought, of will, is an indication that there's a living being, that there's a soul. And of course, this is one of the beginning instructions in Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada one time asked a disciple, well, how do you begin to preach to someone? He says, I try to convince them that there's God. He said, no, first try to convince them that you're not this body, that there's a soul. And again, just seeing that, that we can distinguish whether or not there's a soul present by the behavior of the body and mind, also immediately brings us to the understanding that there's a difference between the soul and the body and mind. If any, how many of you have ever seen any, besides a bug perhaps, how many of you have seen any creature die or any human being die? Any of you seen them die? No? Okay. So it's quite dramatic sometimes, you know. The first creature I saw die was a cat. It had been my pet cat when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. When my mother moved from a house to an apartment, she said, you have to take your cat. So fortunately I was living out at a farm at Gitanagari, Pennsylvania, so I took the cat, and she was already quite old, she only lived a couple months, and she died very gradually, actually, over a few days. And I would go out every day to check on her. I had her like underneath a shelter outside, and you know, sometimes I'd have to look for quite some time. Is she still alive? Is she still alive? Is she still alive? But when she was dead, I knew immediately, oh, she's dead. I read a very interesting story of a man who worked for the government in America capturing predator animals. You know, he'd make traps for like coyotes and mountain lions that were eating the animals of the farmers. And one time he took his 10-year-old son with him and they found a creature, I think it was a mountain lion, that was stuck in one of these traps and it was still alive. And as they watched, the animal died as they came there. And the boy looked at his dad and said, why did the light go out in his eyes? And the man who was writing this article, he was that man, and he said that from that day he quit his job and he started working to preserve the various species instead of killing them. But we can then distinguish there's something different between the person and the body. So I remember when I was trying to explain this to my mother, this would have been maybe 78 or so, and I was saying to her, you know, how we're different from the body. And she said, yeah, just like when someone dies, the body's there, but they're not there. I said, see, so we're not the body. She said, no, I don't believe that. it was quite interesting how, you know, logic isn't sufficient, logic and experience isn't sufficient to convince somebody who doesn't want to be convinced. Now, later on, when she was the one dying, things were a little different for her. She became very interested in Krishna consciousness at the very end of her life, especially the last few days. And it was very interesting when I was there with her. Again, you know, there's my mother, and then there's just my mother's body. It's quite fascinating. And it was particularly fascinating because my mother mentally stayed sharp, but physically she basically lost all her abilities. She went back to being like a newborn baby on a physical level. She couldn't turn over in bed or sit up, or she couldn't even speak. So even though the body had been basically not very animated, she wasn't able to swallow, which is how she died. She died from starvation, essentially. Still, there was quite a difference when she was in the body and she was out of the body. There was an immediate difference. That, oh, my mother is gone. You know, and if we had preserved the body or something, it wouldn't have done any good. I couldn't have talked to it. I couldn't have had a relationship with a preserved dead body. Yeah? You know, it just simply wouldn't work. Just like the Egyptians, they would mummify their pharaohs or something like that. Or they said Walt Disney froze his body. But yeah, one of the things that happens when someone who's dear to you dies is for a while you keep thinking you want to tell them things. You know, I noticed it took me about a year, you know, where I think, oh, I should call my mother. Right? My daughter-in-law's father was telling me that after his wife passed away, that, you know, I think it took him maybe about a year and a half, that he would think, oh, Mula... Oh, you know, and you just realize, okay, I can't actually interact with this person. they're gone. So this is a fairly simple thing to understand. It really doesn't require a lot of buddhi. Even if you're a buddhi, even if you're a buddhi bihi, even if you're not particularly intelligent, and even if you're not particularly qualified, it's a very, very simple thing. Frankly, a child can understand it. And this is one of the basis on which we propagate ahimsa. We don't propagate ahimsa as an absolute principle, otherwise Arjuna wouldn't be told to stand and fight. But ahimsa is a general principle of a civilized society, that other living beings have feelings just like I do. I mean, sometimes it's kind of fascinating if you're out and about in a city like, you know, I was in Dublin. Dublin, you say? Dublin. Dublin. Did I get that right? Dublin. Yesterday. And I took a walk down to the park. And, you know, there's so many people out and about. Do you say out and about? People out and about. And I'm thinking they each have their own lives that are important to them, just as my life is important to me. You know, I have people that I'm particularly close to. I have people that I would like to be particularly far from. I have things, you know, that I have to do today and things that I won't get to today, even though I really should. And I have things that I want and things that I'd like to get rid of and places I'd like to go and places I'd never like to see again and things that I worry about. And, you know, I have all of this, and so does everybody else. You know, they're not just bodies walking past me on the sidewalk. They're a living being. And this is true not only for the human beings, it's true even for the little bugs, you know, like right there, those little bugs, that they're all excited about those flowers. And I think, you know, maybe there's something nice in those flowers. You see the little bugs there, right there? Yeah. So they also have their own little lives. And they also have, you know, they may have someone who's dear to them even. Some bugs live in a colony and they'll die for each other. The bees will sacrifice their life for the sake of the colony. So it's, you know, they have their, and they'll go to war with another colony or they'll go to war with the wasps. You know, and to us it's nothing, but for them it's a huge battle. They're organizing their military. I don't know if they sing patriotic songs or anything like that, but they have, you know, the great battle. I'm not sure if they tell their larva when they hatch. Let me tell you the story of the battle between the bees and the wasps. But still, it's a battle for them, and it's a life and death struggle. And they'll build their homes, you know. Their birds will be building their homes, and they make it very carefully, and they're showing off for their prospective partner. And just like we do, you know, just some human guy drives up in a fancy red convertible to attract some woman, and so the peacock is trying to attract the peahen, and they have feelings, they have desires. Yes. And if somebody comes and breaks their home, they're sad. I was a Gurukul teacher for many years. We used to show the kids, you know, nature films, science films, history, geography. And one that particularly struck me was about scorpion mice. So generally mice are vegetarians, yeah? They generally eat like grains. But these mice ate scorpions. Just imagine that. Warrior mice, you know? Really, they eat scorpions. And they could even get stung by scorpions, and they were immune to the stings up to a point anyway. And they're very, very fierce mice. They would also attack other mice in their own community. They had like friendly mice and enemy mice and things like that. They were very territorial. Even ordinary mice are like that. I don't have time to tell you that story. But anyway, I do have a personal experience with territorial mice. But these... I actually really do. But anyway, so what was particularly interesting about these scorpion mice is even though they were so fierce, and very, very fierce, very courageous, I don't know what kind of karma you get to get that interesting mix of karma and desires. So they were very affectionate to their babies. And if some owl came and ate one of their babies, they would cry. And the mother and father mice would hug each other and cry over the loss of their little baby. And in this way, just with some little observation of nature. Even if you don't study the scripture, even if one is not very intelligent, like Prabhupada says that, he says that even an uneducated person by studying nature can understand something of transcendence. So just by studying nature with the tiniest bit of empathy and the tiniest bit of thought, even a very simple person can understand that life means spirit. Life means something other than the body. And anything that's alive, even a plant, you know, there's a lot of research now that the plants have emotions and have desires. And I read a fascinating book, The Secret Life of Trees, which I really very highly recommend. How trees in a natural forest talk to each other and help each other out. You know, they actually help each other out. If you've ever seen a stump that has new life coming out of it, and you wonder, where did it get the nutrients? Because we all know that plants get their nutrients from the sun. So when you cut off all the branches and all the leaves, how is the plant going to be sustaining itself long enough to produce these shoots? And the answer is that the other trees around that tree, they understand. Oh, some human has cut down our brother. And they send nutrients under the ground through the root system. And they communicate through fungi that's attached to their roots. It is absolutely fascinating. So we get some genuine empathy. Yeah? Of course, it's a sad thing that we Hare Krishna devotees, where we have this philosophical construct as one of our primary understandings, that everybody is a living being like me. Like Krishna says in the sixth chapter, we see happiness and distress of others in relation to our own self. That even in our ISKCON movement, we're sometimes not even kind to our own members. We're sometimes not even kind to our own family members. You know, I've seen devotees be nicer to a cow than to their wife. So it's a real shame that, you know, we don't always take the next step from understanding something intellectually and understanding something theologically and to saying, well, wait a minute, you know, how I deal with every living being matters. It counts. It's important. You know, it's not an inconsequential thing, how I deal with the bugs and how I deal with the plants and how I deal with other, what to speak of, how I deal with other humans, what to speak of, how I deal with other devotees. And then going on to God. So we talked about how we can deduce the soul from the actions of the body and mind. But how can we deduce the presence of God? So that is given here, that we can deduce the presence of God from the existence of the universal body and the universal mind. That the universe is understood in the Shastra as being a great body, a Virat Rupa. And there's a lot of the Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita given to understanding this universal body. And again, if we're going to start where we are, you know, I don't look around and see God everywhere. Premanjana Jarita Bhakti Vilochanema Santa Sadaiva Ridayeshi Vilokanti Yam Shaima Sundarama Chintigunas Rupa. So I don't see God in every atom because I don't have love, as Prabhupada says here, without the necessary qualification. So I don't have the necessary qualification. I look around and I just see the universal body. And so there's a lot of the Shastra, just like there's a lot of the Shastra to teach us that we are a soul and that other living beings are soul. There's a lot of the Shastra that teach us that the universe is the body of God. There's chapters in the Bhagavatam dedicated, parts of chapters, especially in the second canto, but also even, you know, with Vamandev and so forth, the whole description in the fifth canto. Any of you ever wonder why? There's all that cosmology in the fifth canto. What's it doing there? Why do we even study this stuff? I mean, Maharaj Prakrit was about to die. So if you got notice from the doctor, 7 days you're going to die, would you say, please tell me about the movements of Mercury and Jupiter? Is that what you would ask to hear? You know, well, sometimes Mercury goes retrograde. That's in the fifth canto. Yeah? You know, and that would be, so, the fifth out of 12 cantos, out of 7 days, or maybe like day three or something. So, you know, day three of the 7 days you have left, and you're hearing about the movements of the planet. So, why? Because the universe is the body of God. And it's explaining, actually, the movements and the happenings within the body of God. just like in our own body, we might study about the movements of the blood and the movements of the lymph and so forth, and the bile, and the air. Yes, we have some interest in that, don't we? Because it's our body. Maybe if you're very young and very healthy, you have no interest in such things. But most of us have some interest in how the body functions, isn't it? So also those who want to love God have some interest in how even this universal body is functioning. And how can we detect the presence of God in the universal body? Well, things are in order. Yeah? Just like in our body, it has a particular system, and the systems are coordinated with each other, and they work in a very particular way. And you can understand from that, oh, there's somebody running the show. Isn't it? Yes? So the universe is very orderly. I mean, it's extraordinarily orderly, talking about the movements of the planets. So we can predict the movements of the planets thousands of years in advance of now, and we can understand the movements of the planets thousands of years in the past. In fact, one of the ways that we get a specific date for the beginning of Kali Yuga is that there's mentioned in the Bhagavatam about where the planets were. So we can calculate, when would the planets have been in that place? Oh, it would have been in that place on this particular date. You know, try doing that for some man-made object. You know? I mean, if we could do that for airplanes, we wouldn't need air traffic controllers, would we? So I read a fascinating account recently of the air traffic controllers at Newark Airport in America, which made me never want to fly in or out of Newark Airport in America again. But it's evidently one of the busiest airports in the world in terms of the air traffic coming from different directions, but it has very antiquated equipment. And just the incredible, incredible psychological stress that these people, I think they're all male, are under when they're managing this aircraft. Because, you know, if you just mess up a little tiny bit, then you've got hundreds of people dead. That's your responsibility. Imagine having that kind of a job, right? That you just make the slightest error, or you just don't pay attention for a second, and you've got a crash and 500 people dead. So it's a really intense, intense thing. But sometimes the equipment fails. Sometimes they're talking, and it's obvious the pilot can't hear them. You know, and they're just like, they start sweating buckets, and they wet their pants, literally, actually. And it's the kind of job where people sometimes have meltdowns. You know, sometimes there'll be a situation where the planes barely, barely don't crash. And then the person just starts shaking. And they fall on the ground, and they have kind of a meltdown. And someone else has to quickly get into their seat and take it over. And there's guards walking around. There's like supervisors walking around to notice if somebody's on the verge of a meltdown and try to immediately have somebody replace them before they lose it. You know, and there's hardly anybody who can do that job, especially at that particular airport. It requires a tremendous amount of skill. And so the people who are skilled in that, they're working very, very long shifts because they don't have enough people that are qualified to do this job. But if you always knew where all the airplanes were going to be at every moment, you wouldn't need to have anybody doing the job at all. You know, there'd just be a specific path, and you could always say, flight number FL-221 is going to be at this particular spot in the sky at that particular time. Right? And it's sort of like with the planets. So we don't find the planets crashing into each other. You know, it's not like that. So that must be somebody very intelligent that's running the show. So we have evidence in the universal body that there must be a God. And we have evidence that there's a universal mind as well. Right? That it's not just some machine, but it's a machine that has some intelligence behind it. And this morning I was hearing Prabhupada talk about flowers. You know, each of these flowers. So, you know, you're saying if we want to paint one of these flowers. So, you want to paint one of these flowers. So, you know, it has actually several different shades, and the petals are one shade on the bottom and another shade on the top, and there's different shapes and so forth. And it would take each of us quite a while to paint this flower accurately, wouldn't it? Any of us have the skill that we could paint this so it looked like a photograph? That requires years of study, yeah? And even then, you know, it would It would really take us quite a while. So there must be also a universal mind that's able to do something like that. Yes, and we can get some indication of what is the nature of God by looking at nature. Just like so. Okay, so I have that marigold flower. And if we look carefully at this garland, so we'll see. My guess is that flower and this flower probably came from the same plant. Yeah? Probably? Mm-hmm. Yes? But are the flowers exactly the same? Mm-hmm. Is the pattern on the flowers exactly the same? No? So that's interesting, isn't it? So first of all, we have several different flowers here. We have mums and we have marigolds. So at least we have two different kinds of flowers in this particular garland. And then you can see that we have different marigolds, yes? Yeah. So even among the marigolds, there's differences in the marigolds. And then even among the marigolds from the same plant, there's still differences. If you look at any plant, among any plant, we'll have the leaves are different. Each leaf on the plant is different from each other. Each of our fingers is a little different from each other. So we can say something that God likes variety. It's a God that whoever the universal mind is, the universal, the soul of the universe, likes variety. And must like variety actually rather an extreme way, that every single flower on the same plant is slightly different. Every snowflake is a little different. You get snow here? Sometimes when I give that example, I'm thinking, they even never see snow, even in Dubai or something. So, but every snowflake is different. And who cares? I mean, who's going to look at every snowflake? Obviously Krishna cares, you know, the mind of the universe cares. Every grain of sand. You know, I once heard a devotee say, are you going to say every grain of sand is different? I said, yeah, look it up. So this is a homework, home fun assignment. Look it up. Go on the internet. Look up. Magnified grains of sand. They're each beautiful. Each grain of sand is a work of art. Each snowflake is a work of art. So that the universal mind is interested in variety and individuality. The universal mind is a great artist. Every time the sun rises and sets, we have a work of art, isn't it? Abstract art also. The universal mind has a variety of artistic styles, all the way from, you know, very particular and detailed to great abstract works of art. And we also see that although there's order, there's also surprises. So we all count on the earth being there for us. We count on being able to walk around, and every once in a while the earth may go and then you can't count on it anymore. So the universal mind also likes surprises, and there's paradoxes. So generally, when we do good, we feel happy. When we do bad, we feel unhappy. But yet we see sometimes bad people seem to be happy and good people seem to be unhappy. There's all kinds of paradoxes. Yes? So the universal mind is a mind of mystery and paradoxes and apparent contradictions and difficulty. The universal mind also likes patterns. So although there's individuality, extreme individuality, they're also repeating patterns. What is that called? What is that called, that pattern?
Fibonacci.
Fibonacci. There's the Fibonacci pattern. That's a repeating pattern. And then there's certain patterns that repeat in nature, which is one of the reasons that people say there's evidence for evolution, because there's repeating patterns in the DNA. You know, it's not that every single form is absolutely unique from every other form. And this is why scientists can test medicines on animals, because there's certain repeating patterns. Yeah? So these are things that we can understand. Even if we're not very intelligent, and even if we're not very spiritually qualified, we can still look at the universe. And it's quite interesting that at the present time, when people are moving away from organized religion and moving more to secularism or spirituality, that a rising conception of God in the world in 2019 is the universe. So in science, the ultimate God is the universe. And among so many spiritual groups, or quasi-spiritual, or pseudo-spiritual, or whatever it may be, they talk about the universe. Isn't it a fact? Mm-hmm. Yes? And we may look at that and scoff and go, oh, you're just talking about the universe. And we talk about Govinda with his flute. But again, you know, I don't know how much I can see Govinda with his flute. And I mean, I obviously can see him there, but how much can I really see him? Where am I? Where am I in my own realization? But I can see the universe. And the scripture is full of descriptions of the universe and how to meditate on God in the universe. So I was really so happy when I saw today's verse, because this is a project that I'm working on right now. I've been working on it actually for many, many years, working out with a devotee named Kamalasita, a disciple of Indrajuna Swami, and both of us are doctors of education. And BBT Africa has agreed to publish it. We're in our editing stages. And what we've done is we've taken all the statements from the Bhagavatam about the universal form and all the statements from the Bhagavad Gita about you can see me in the world like this. I am the light of the sun. Well, tell me some of them. Can you tell me what are some of the things that Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, how we can see him in nature? Somebody tell me some.
And the voice of birds, he says,
He says, I'm the sound in all the sound in space, which would include the voice of birds. He doesn't specifically say I'm the voice of birds, but he said he's all sound in ether. And in the Bhagavatam, it says that birds are indicative of his
artistic
of his, that he's a master of artistry. Okay, some more? Either from Gita or Bhagavatam.
Fishes and shark.
Of fishes, I am the shark, yes. It's actually the word is makara.
Mm. The heat and fire.
Heat and fire, yes.
Smell of the earth.
The smell of the earth.
Taste in the water.
Taste in the water.
Cheating of the cheats.
Gambling of the cheats.
Gambling of the cheats.
Prowess
of powerful demons.
The prowess of the powerful demons. And in the Bhagavatam, it says that the demon soldiers are his power.
The strength of the strong devoid of
passion and desire. Yes, the strength of the strong. Actually, he says, I'm the strength of the strong. And then he also says, I'm strength devoid of passion and desire. Well, yes, some others?
Of secrets and silence.
Of secrets and silence.
The ability in man.
Ability in humans, yes.
Immovable objects, the Himalayas?
Yes.
Mountains, Mount Meru.
Mountains, Mount Meru.
Sacrifices is japa.
Of yajna is japa, yes. Samar.
Taste and water,
huh?
The rising and setting of sun is his outfit.
Yes, it's his garments. Yes. Yes. The twilight time is his garments, yes.
The sacred
garment. Huh? The banyan tree.
Original fragrance of the earth.
You said that, yeah? Fragrance of the earth, yes.
Is most...
Do you think this might be important?
Very important.
Might it be? If what we're able to perceive is the universe... Now, if any of you can right now see Govinda dancing, that might not be quite as important for you. But even then, Maharaj Pariksit took a lot of time with it. And Arjuna had a lot of time with it, even though Krishna was personally standing before him. So if we're going to start where we are, and that's where we are, it might be really important to try to see God in the universe. Just like it's important to see that there's a soul in the other living beings that I interact with.
Because he says that you're never lost to him, for one who sees everything in me. So you're never lost to him. So if you don't perceive Krishna in everything, then you are blinded to Krishna.
Very nice. Thank you so much for bringing up that verse in this connection. Then what to speak about preaching? I mean, it's lovely and it's important, and we should preach to people that God is a blue cowherd boy playing his flute and swimming in the Yamuna. We definitely should preach like that to people. We should definitely tell them that. But don't you think we should also tell them that he is the universe? And how to find him in the universe? How to find him in their daily lives? My personal, very, very strong belief is that one of the main reasons that we have not spread Krishna consciousness widely is that we are indirectly, and sometimes quite directly, preaching a world-denying monastic philosophy. That we are saying, if you really want to be a devotee, then what that means is that you have to give up the world and move into the ashram. And anything else is second rate or third rate or tenth rate or, you know, whatever. And that was very much the mood when I joined this one. And I see that it's the mood that is tended to prevail. So that people think, you know, if I have my own home and I have a job and I have a business, then I'm not really a devotee. I even know some places that talk about that the full-time devotees are those, you know, who live in the on ISKCON properties and work full-time for the ISKCON mission directly, and everyone else isn't a full-time devotee. But if that's the way we think, we are never going to spread Krishna consciousness all over the world. First of all, we'd have to have a very big ashram. And I'm not quite sure who would give the donations for it. It might be a little difficult. Yeah? And we've never seen any religious system spread in that way. Just like there are Catholic monasteries and convents, but that's always been a minority of the Catholic world. Isn't that a fact? And the Catholic preaching isn't that everybody has to, you know. That's there and it's important. It happens to be extremely important. But it's not everything and it's not a society. And to build a society, we have to find God where we are. We have to be able to find God where we are. And if we're going to make a God-conscious world, another book that I'm working on, which is also in the editing stage, I'm working on with a devotee named Rukmini, not my god sister. Her legal name is Dr. Ruchira Dutta. She's got a degree in mathematics. Is about how to spiritualize your career. And part of spiritualizing your career is seeing God in everything. But this requires some care. Just like I can walk down the street in Dublin, and I can just see, there are the bodies, or bodies, there are the bodies walking past me. Or I can see, there are people with their own lives and their own interests and their own concerns. That's up to me. Do I go about my business blindly in tamagun? Or do I go about my business in sattvagun or in bhakti? You know, that's my choice. And it's the same thing with the world. The light of the sun is coming into this room. Do I have any awareness of it? Do I have any awareness that this light is Krishna? And how is it Krishna? Well, it allows me to see things. It allows me to gain knowledge. Just like Krishna allows me to have sought knowledge and to see things. And the heat and fire, well, there's not a lot of heat in this room, but there is some. I mean, I'm able to function with a light wool chadar. I'm not wrapped up in my full winter regalia. And even if it was the dead of winter, there'd still be some heat in the room, or else we'd all keel over dead from hypothermia. And there's heat in my body, but are we aware of it? Can we feel the heat in the room and the heat in our body? And how is that Krishna? Well, heat is a symptom of life. Krishna's alive. Actually, our atmosphere with its heat is full of life. Or our ability, your ability to make garlands, to make ghee wicks, you can even do it without looking at what you're doing. Our ability to sit, to hear, to see. Do we just sit and hear and see? And use the scissors? That's not so easy, using the scissors, right? Do you have a child? Remember how long it took for him to learn how to use a scissor? It's quite a skill. And that's our ability. And do we just use our ability kind of for granted, or do we understand? It's Krishna. When I can move my hands, that ability is Krishna. The intelligence of the intelligent. That is Krishna. You know, when you see the birds here, do you think, oh, there's a bird? Or do you see nothing at all and just kind of walk past them? Or does it become, oh, there's Krishna. Look at the artistry of their form, the artistry of their sound, the artistry of their movement. What a master artist. You know, and the sounds in ether. It's a very quiet place. The only sound I hear is the clock. But that's also, there's one lecture where Prabhupada says that if you don't want to chant Hare Krishna, you can meditate on how Krishna is all of the sounds in space. He said, actually, all sound is originally spiritual sound. But when we don't see Krishna there, it becomes material. So how could that sound, how could I understand that Krishna is that sound? It could maybe be, maybe that's a reflection of the sound of an instrument there while Krishna is dancing with Calvin. So to connect with the Lord through what we have, through where we are. To meditate on how Krishna is in my environment all the time. I find it very nice to meditate on how Krishna is a super soul. And to just think about that every living being I see is not only are they a person like me with feelings and desires and so forth, but they're a walking temple and they're walking around with their best friend. Imagine if we could actually see that. You know, if we actually look at people and see they're, each person's walking around with Krishna next to them. Hey, remember you wanted to do that last life? Here's your opportunity. And here's how to do that. And here's that. If we just see that, at least we can meditate on that. There's somebody with Krishna. There's a very nice, kind of heavy, I don't know if it's nice, kind of heavy, quote from Bhaktisiddhanta where he says, don't try to be the reformer of anyone because no one is without the highest guidance. And I understand that when we're preaching, what we're doing is we're just assisting the super soul who's already giving the highest guidance. And it's such a nice meditation. No one is without the highest guidance. Krishna is always with them. In this way, we behave as if Krishna is everywhere. And if we behave as if we're a soul, then of course we're going to engage in bhakti. So although we have to start where we are, we shouldn't stay where we are. We should move forward. We should move forward. So we meditate on how Krishna is in the world. We meditate how everyone is a soul. And we move forward to meditating also how Krishna is in Vrindavan. And now Krishna is enjoying so many nice pictures here in the temple room of Krishna's pastimes. And I didn't get all the way around the island this morning, but it's so lovely, all of the different pastime places, all of the lila stans that you have here. Frankly, I don't know, this is being recorded and someone's going to shoot me for this, but I like it better than what they've done at New Vrajdham because you have signs everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, you know, writing to Shiva Ram Maharaj and say, would you put up some signage? You know, I mean, what are you going to do? Carry around the 9-volume book with you when you go around the property? What is this place? What is that place? So it's nice. It was going around and seeing all the different signage. And then we really... So then we go past where we are. And we go to meditating on the transcendent. But if we only try to meditate on the transcendent Krishna, and we don't also try to meditate on how Krishna is here, then we're not following the Ishopanishad. Sambhutam, asambhutam. Both. On the temporary and the eternal. We have to know both. And that doesn't just mean that we're trying to know the temporary in terms of something secular, but we're trying to know the temporary in relationship to the eternal. And therefore we find the scriptures emphasize both. Right? This is the section of the different incarnations. So we're interested in Varaha and Nisinga and Kurma and Matsya and Krishna and Balaram and Ramachandra. And we're also interested in the heat and fire. We're also interested, what are the trees?
The hairs.
Mm-hmm. Just imagine that. So when we're walking out and about, we're walking on the hairs on his body. That's so sweet, isn't it? It's very intimate. Our connection with him is very intimate. And we have both things simultaneously. Here are the trees as the hairs in his body. Oh, and there's where Lord Brahma performed the marriage of Radha and Govind. So actually Krishna consciousness is, I think, that's why I'm here. Somebody in some other religion or group may have their own opinion to which they are certainly entitled.
But I think that this philosophy given in the Srimad Bhagavatam and this philosophy given by Sri Chaitanya and so kindly brought to all of us by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada is beautiful. It's completely holistic. We see God as the transcendent flute player decorated with a flower garland. And we also see the Lord in the flowers, in the beauty of the flowers, in the atoms of the flute. We see, and this way, we get to start where we are and we get to go past where we are to total transcendence. So, I neither ended at 8:30 or at 9, but rather in the middle. So, I hope that is satisfying. Of course, if we have a lot of questions, we probably will go to 9. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Or yes?
I find it really helpful to think that Krishna is all good. I think that Krishna is all good. It gives me a measure to understand what are the influences that are, say, Kali, coming from Kali and destroying, say, this beautiful nature, and also the intention of someone else, if, you know, it is not a good intention, I can understand this is not good for me, like, as a living being. So I find it really nice to also think Krishna is all good.
What a beautiful meditation, thank you. There's a nice statement in Bhagavad Gita 15:15 in the purport that you might want to refer to. That's your personal home fun assignment.
What is it?
15:15. So this is my personal request to you as your home fun assignment. I don't give homework, I only give home fun. to read the purport, Prabhupada's purport to Bhagavad Gita 15:15. Oh, now I want to tell you a funny story about 15:15. So 15:15 is... Any of you know 15:15? Yes. Sarvasya chaham riddhi sannivisto matasmajyagyanam apohanam cha. Right, so Krishna says, from me come what?
Knowledge,
remembrance, and forgetfulness. So in our family, 15:15 was our go-to verse whenever we couldn't find something. So, you know, where are my keys? Chant 15:15. Right? And then the person goes around the house, Sarvasya Cham Ridi Sanivistam, Matasmachyurganam Pohanam Cha. So one time when I was traveling, there was a devotee staying in the ashram where I was staying, and she says, Urmila, Urmila, I can't find my phone. And I said, well, chant 15:15. And she went around saying, 15:15, 15:15. No, not until she actually started. Once she started chanting, actually 15:15, then she very quickly found her phone. Sorry, I couldn't resist that one. Anybody else? Any questions, comments? Yes.
We're talking. There's two things I find interesting. We're talking about this sense of the society, and Prabhupada was very keen to set up an international society.
Yes.
And that means that we have to be all embracing of different levels of activities and different people. But we are, as a movement, very insular. You know, like, we don't actually really have, you know, I grew up in this town with kind of the karmas. You know,
yeah.
So, like, if you had a contagion, you know. And looks like, you know, if we continue on in that insular path, then we are actually not being true to Prabhupada's mission. We can actually maintain standards within an institution, but we certainly can't preach within four walls and never seen anything outside. So I just think that it's a real discussion that we have to have within the movement and revisit it again and again.
Absolutely.
You know, because...
And we haven't even been able to maintain standards within our own institution, by the way.
Yeah, no, but like as an ideal kind of, it should be. But the other one was balancing your profession and this idea that like full-time devotees are those that are within the temple. I think it's a real endemic problem that we have. You know, kind of people kind of think of you differently, like you're doing some kind of voodoo behind your closed doors as you go home at night time. And I found that it's created a great division within our society. where we can't collectively, you know, work together. But balancing your work and your everyday, that's a real meditation, because you may be working on coalface and very difficult situations and being constantly able to do what Prabhupada said, do what you do with just that Krishna, is very difficult. And it's something that I have a challenge with all the time, because I work with very disturbed adults, you know, I teach. And, you know, so it's very hard when you have somebody who's come in and they've just, you know, changed their methadone, for instance, you know, to actually sit down and say, here's a living entity and I'm here to do good for them, you know, and you're just trying to maintain calm in a classroom. But I find that if you don't have the support within your own community to be a devotee who works outside, then that meditation becomes even more difficult.
I really like what you're saying. To try to put this into practice on your own is extremely difficult.
For the artwork that you were referring to, that Mataji, she's a hairdresser. And I've heard people, you know, say, what a low-class job, ooh, she's working with a stool all the time. I've heard people say this, you know. Yet she's an artist, and she makes great art of somebody's head, but then she comes and these pictures are her manifestations, and all of these pastimes are her manifestations. But yet, within our own community, people refer to her day job as working with a stool. You know, do you see what I mean?
So yes.
That doesn't enable that Mataji to actually...
Well, I was asked by one GBC man a few months ago, how can we make ISKCON more Prabhupada-centered? Mm-hmm. And he was concerned because various other Gaudiya groups keep taking people from ISKCON, and in the community where he's based, that's happening. And he was talking about how can we get like a very personal relationship with Prabhupada, and I said, I don't think that's something that you can teach or mandate. I said, I think, you know, on a very personal level, having a relationship with Prabhupada is just personal, and it has to develop in each person in their own way. I said, but how we can be connected with Srila Prabhupada in a very meaningful way in our movement is to be connected with his mission. And I don't think we even talk about it. I don't even think we have a clear idea of what the world is. You know, I've had experience with ISKCON leaders where I asked them, you know, okay, if your whole country were to be under Lord Chaitanya's movement, what would people be doing? And they haven't a clue. They just haven't a clue. That was, you know, I asked this once at a... I don't know if I should say this or not. I mean, it is recorded. It is online, so I might as well just say it, even though it's being recorded here. But I was at the European Leaders Meeting in 2014, and I was heavily pressured and coerced into giving a three-hour presentation on women in ISKCON. And I started off innocently enough thinking that all the European leaders had done a lot of this visioning in their own life, that I was asking them to do something that they'd already done many, many times. And so I said, let's imagine that all of Europe is in Mahaprabhu's movement. Imagine it's 10 years from now. Imagine it's 2024. And all of Europe is in Mahaprabhu's movement. Get into groups and discuss what women are doing. I said, you can discuss in terms of career, which is Varna, social, which is ashram. I also made a category of intellectual, and in bhakti. So they got into groups, and these were all the leaders of ISKCON in Europe. And the first group said, well, we looked at career, and now that Europe is in Mahaprabhu's women movement, well, women don't have any careers. They said the only career they have is as wives and mothers. Which, of course, isn't a career at all. It's an ashram, not varna. And then one of them said, well, some of them are princesses. And then one of them said, and some of them are prostitutes. Now, very thankfully at that time, I was working on about 2 hours of sleep. So, keeping in mind that Prabhupada said that without sleep you have no intelligence, I kept my mouth very firmly shut. And I simply did not respond other than just to, inside, be completely shocked. And thinking, A, do any of you have daughters? B, obviously none of you have ever spent 5 minutes of your life having a vision for what a Krishna conscious society would look like, and see, thank you, Krishna, that we are not running the world. So these were my main thoughts. You know, okay, can you imagine this? Just imagine this. You know, we were interviewed by the press, and what's your vision for women in a utopian society? Oh, well, they'll all be wives, mothers, princesses, or prostitutes. Those are their career choices. I'm like, so, and this was a pretty universal that people decided that women in an ideal society had no career other than being wives and mothers. And then I challenged everyone and I said, well, if you really believe I didn't go the way I could have gone because I was too tired and I didn't trust what I would say at all. But I went in the direction of saying, well, if you really believe that in an ideal society women would be wives and mothers, what are you doing right now in your temples to help women become wives and mothers? I said, do you have matchmaking services? Do you have training in the Grihastha Ashram? Does everybody get seminars to train them in the Grihastha Ashram? Do you insist when people are between age 20 and 25 that they choose either marriage or renunciation? Do you help people get married young? Do you have courses in parenting? Do you have programs? Do you have nursery school programs for the little children? Do you have a room in your temple for little children to go so the parents can listen to class and so forth without disturbing everyone? Do you have a school in your community? What are you doing to promote marriage and children in your temple? And of course, most of them just kind of looked at the floor. So I said, even if this is your vision for the future, what are you doing today to move in that direction? And of course, with some notable and wonderful exceptions, most of them were doing absolutely nothing. And since then, I just didn't know that our leaders were not thinking in that way. And since then, I've become very enthusiastic that any place I go where people are enthusiastic, I mean, my doctorate is not just in education, but is in educational leadership. And so I have a lot of doctoral training in organizational theory and organizational structure. It's my field. And so whenever I'm someplace where people are interested in this, which is not very many places, then it's one of the things that we do. We do a visioning exercise. We imagine it's already 10 years in the future, that we're in the future, and that we've transformed the local city or the local county or the local country or whatever into Mahaprabhu's movement. And then we start discussing, well, what does it look like? I like to start at the top with the varnas. What's happening in universities? What's happening in children's education? What's happening in medicine? What's happening in religion? What's happening in government, in the legislature, in the military, the police force, and the different regulations? What's happening in agriculture? What's happening in business? What's happening in trade? And what's happening in the arts? Wouldn't we like it if every, as we call them in America, sanitation workers, which means they're garbage, we used to call them garbage men when I was a kid, would we like them all to be pure devotees? Suppose all the heads of state in the world were all devotees of Krishna. Would we like that?
Yes.
Would we like it if Monsanto was taken over by a devotee?
Yes.
That would be lovely, wouldn't it? And then if a devotee goes out and has a job, we tell them that they're working with stool. That's rather odd. So first we're saying that we'd like all the hairdressers in the world to be great devotees, all the shopkeepers to be... I mean, wouldn't we?
Yes.
Wouldn't we like it if all the shopkeepers and all the barbers and all of the artists and the musicians and the gymnasts and the athletes and the agriculturists and the business people and the military leaders and the judges and the people in parliament and the professors and the scientists were all devotees of God? And when Prabhupada was talking about this one time, the gentleman he was talking to said, oh, does this mean they all have to be ISKCON members? Prabhupada said, no. He said, math is mathematics. It doesn't matter where you learned it, but they have to be God conscious. Wouldn't we like this? So if we would like this, genuinely like this, then we should A, train people already in those positions how to be God conscious. And we can start with the universe. And take people who are already God conscious and have them be exemplary in all these different positions. That makes a whole lot of sense to me. Take people who are already in the positions and help them to be God conscious. Take people who are already in the Krishna consciousness movement and help them to be exemplary so we can say, be a hairdresser like that. Be a shopkeeper like that. Be a teacher like that. Here's an exemplary person for you. But if our vision for a Krishna conscious world is just kind of the world's going to hell and we're on our little farms milking our cows with our solar panels, and our walls around us or something. I don't know that wasn't the movement I joined, you know? It wasn't. It just wasn't. You know, I did have a kind of idea that just by running around the Chicago airport with Back to Godhead magazines and my saffron polycotton sari pinned over my head like this, because the fabric was so heavy that if I didn't pin it there, it would fall off and the pin would move up. And I had this humongous nose ring on it. So I thought that by doing that I was going to transform the world in 18 days or something. But, you know, I didn't really have a clear idea of what I was going to transform the world to, which is, again, fascinating, because it's all over Srila Prabhupada's books and all over Srila Prabhupada's lectures, what he wants to transform the world to. And I'm also personally very convinced that if we started having a vision, you know, let's first have it, and then if we talked about it, that we would re-inspire a lot of our devotees who are having trouble, you know, like you're saying, well, we're trying to keep an insular society with high standards. I'm sorry, that is a failure. I'm really sorry to say this. Can I say this?
Yeah.
It's a failure. It is a failure. People have high standards, they take initiation, and most of them don't keep it. Am I telling the truth?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
What is the percentage of our core that comes, takes vows, and keeps those vows steadily for decades? What is our percentage? It is not a high percentage. You know, we have a lot of other people who are trying, and they're doing something, and they're doing what they can, and they're participating. And either they just say, well, I can't do it, and I'm just openly going to do whatever I'm doing, or they pretend that they're doing it, and then there's some scandal. Huh? But what's part of what enthuses us to keep our standards? We have kind of an irony about trying to keep our standards for our own spiritual advancement. If I'm trying to keep my standards for my own spiritual advancement, one irony is that the more I advance, the less I think I'm advancing. Yes, this is exactly what happens. I heard Bhakti Jiswami saying this in class. The more I become Krishna conscious, the more I'm aware of how fallen I am. Yes, you all have this experience? And so on a material level, that's very discouraging. I mean, and in fact, we discourage people from admitting to themselves or anyone else that they are, in fact, making any advancement. It's part of our social milieu. It's part of our humility culture. That nobody can ever say that they're becoming Krishna conscious. It's you know, it's completely taboo. If you're like, wow, I'm really experiencing Krishna in the heat and fire, you're like, what is wrong with you? You know, what do you think you are, some great devotee or something? I mean, I remember once being in front of the deities and at deity greeting and turning to the devotee next to me and saying to her, wow, Krishna is so handsome. She said, are we allowed to think like that? I said, who do you want to think is handsome? You know, movie star? So we have a culture in ISKCON where we're not allowed to think that we're making any progress, and we're not allowed to talk about the fact that we're making any progress. And then as we make progress, we feel more and more and more and more and more and more fallen. So that's a very discouraging kind of situation, because unless you can feel that you're making progress, why should you keep at it? So we have that kind of working against us. And then if we're not inspired by the vision, then we're not going to stay strong in Krishna consciousness for the sake of a higher cause. And one of the main ways that human beings are motivated, which is actually kind of my specialty, is motivation and job satisfaction, is feeling that you're doing something for something greater than yourself. And that's another thing, even if we were a little bit more able to talk about how we are realizing Krishna, even if that was more part of our social scene, still, how much are you going to work on Krishna consciousness just for yourself? In fact, Prahlad Maharaj condemns that. He condemns the people who just think about their own spiritual advancement. We want to think about others. And again, even materially, it's a lot more inspiring to work when you're maintaining your family than when you're just maintaining yourself. How many of you cook? How many of you know how to cook? Cook. How many of you cook? Have you ever cooked just for yourself?
Yes, doctor.
It's so uninspiring. It's really uninspiring. I mean, you just end up making like khichdi or pasta or something.
Toast.
Toast, yeah. it's really, really, really uninspiring. And sometimes it's hard if it's just you for an extended period of time. And you kind of get really bored of toast. And you're like, I need some variety in my food, but it's hard to get in the kitchen and do it. But as soon as you have a guest, oh, it's easy. As soon as you have a guest, oh, I'll make chapati, rice, dal, sabji. I'll put cashews and saffron in the rice, you know, and paneer in the sabji. Right? Maybe I'll even make a dessert. You're never going to do that cooking for yourself. It's like, come on. So we're like that. If we're just doing something for our own benefit, we're not very inspired. So just to try to attain Krishna Prema for myself, first of all, it feels impossible. And we have a culture of trying to convince each other that it is impossible, which is completely strange and counterproductive. But even putting that aside, I would work for Krishna Prema, even though I thought I personally will absolutely never attain it, if I thought that by doing so I could transform the world. I care about that. I really do. I'd like to stop the plastic in the oceans and the burning of the Amazon and the trafficking of young girls into prostitution. I'd like to stop. Wouldn't you all like to stop that stuff? And if I thought that by chanting my 16 rounds and chanting my Gayatris and offering my food, that I could have some impact on that, that would be a whole lot more inspiring than thinking I'm going to chant my rounds to attain Krishna Prema, which I ain't never going to attain anyway, and I just become more and more fallen the more I chant, and I don't even know why I bother. You know? But if we're not preaching the vision, if we don't even have one,
sorry,
if we don't even have a vision, if we think in a Krishna-conscious society all women will be wise mothers, princesses, or prostitutes, if that's our vision, how am I going to become inspired for that? That's not inspiring. That's depressing. And it pervades everything. It pervades our own family of devotees so that we tell people working in the world, this is all rubbish. It's all stool. How sad. And we're shooting ourselves in the foot. So I'm trying to do my little bit. I'm a very insignificant jiva, but I'm trying to do my little bit. And each of us can do our little bit. I mean, one thing we can start to do is start having visioning sessions. And I've seen that some temples, they have visioning sessions for their temple. I know, start with the world. Or start with your town. Or your county. Or your country, if you'd be that bold.
Sometimes, you know, like, and we've had this here, is actually the visioning sessions are for temple and the rest of the community aren't part of that.
Well, that's like if you have a vision for your heart health without thinking of your stomach.
Yeah.
Or if you had a vision for your heart health without thinking of the family you live with. If you say, okay, well, I'm going to go on this diet for the health of my heart, and you're not thinking, how is this going to interplay with my husband and my kids? And I don't think we can have a personal mission statement, and I don't think we can have a temple mission statement. I don't think we can have even a ISKCON-connected devotee mission statement unless we look at the bigger picture, because we are a preaching movement. We are not a Bhajananandi movement. We are not an insular ethnic religion. Why would we ever imagine that we are? We're followers of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Sri Nityananda. As far as I know, they're standing on the altar. That's who they are, yeah? Okay, I was just wondering if that's who they are. So if that's who they are, if this is our movement, if we're Mahaprabhu's movement, and I think that's Srila Prabhupada there, yeah, am I right? Is that him? If this is his movement, so I'm firmly convinced, I'm absolutely firmly convinced that the vision statement has to start with what's our vision for Ireland. Or at least, what's our vision for this county of Ireland if Ireland is too overwhelming? You know, if by 2029 this county was a Krishna conscious county. What's the name of this county?
Fermanagh.
Did I get that right?
Fermanagh.
Starts with an F?
Yes.
Fermanagh. So let's say right now it's 2029 and Fermanagh is fully in Mahaprabhu's movement. And if I really want to be bold, I can go to Ireland. What's happening? What are people doing? What does it look like? And you imagine that you're in 2029. It's a kind of a psychological trick. You imagine that you're in 2029. You use present tense verbs for 2029 and past tense verbs for 2019. So you're not looking into 2029. You're in 2029. And you're looking around. What's happening with the local government? What's the mayor of the town doing? What's happening with the environment? What's happening in the schools? And it helps you can organize it by Varna. So you can start with the Brahmana Varna. What's happening in the universities? Do you have any university in this county?
Yeah, college.
You have a college. So what's happening in the college? What are they teaching? How are they teaching it? What's happening in the schools for children? You know, are there scientists in this area? Have any scientific thing going on in the county at all?
Okay.
So what are the scientists doing? And what's happening with religions? How many temples are there now in Forbatten?
For Fermanagh.
How many ISKCON temples are in Fermanagh County? Are there other Gaudiya Vaishnava temples in Fermanagh County that aren't ISKCON? Are they here too? Are there any, what about other Vaishnav Sampradayas? Are there any Sri Sampradaya temples or Nimbarka temples? And what's happening with the churches? What's going on in the... Are there any churches now in 2019? You know, or is everything an ISKCON temple? And if there's churches, what's happening in them? Well, what are they doing? Are there any mosques? Are there any synagogues? And what's happening there? And what's the relationship between the religions and the government? And what's the relationship between ISKCON and the government? What's happening in medicine? So what's going on? Do you have any hospitals in Forbatten County? So... You know, what's happening in the hospitals? How are they practicing medicine? What's happening in the doctor's offices? And then, as I say, what's happening in the government? What's with the police force, with the firefighters, with any of the local mayors or whatever? And then, well, what about the environment? So how is the environment being taken care of? What kind of agriculture is going on? What kind of businesses? What kind of trade? You know, and then you go down to the artisans. What's happening in the barbershops and what's happening in the art galleries? And what kind of music are people listening to? And what sort of dramas are happening? And what's playing? Is there a local radio station? You know, what are they playing? What are they doing? And you ask yourself these kind of questions and you sit down for, you know, a few hours, 4 or 5 hours. And you work it out. And it's all right if it's a little bit wrong. In other words, it's all right if it actually comes to 2029. And for Fermanagh County became fully Krishna conscious and ends up looking a little different than you had in your vision way back in 2019. It's okay. That's okay. You know, we didn't have to have gotten it all completely right way back in 2019. You know, that's all right. But then once we have that, then we start saying, okay, where do we fit in? Just like what I mentioned about the ELM meeting. If you want those women to be wives and mothers, are you helping them get married? Are you helping them have a happy marriage? Are you providing facility for their children now? If that's where you want to go. So if this is where, once I decide where I want to go, then I see, how do I get from here to there? What should I be doing now? What kind of preaching should I be doing in the community? And how should I be going about it? And how should I be encouraging the members that I already have? Look at it as a whole. What becomes the function of this temple then? What does this temple's primary function become? Just be a monk for 10 days? Or do we have some other functions? Maybe it should be Here's a course as to how to spiritualize your career. Here's a course as to how to spiritualize your family. We can be a monk for 10 days, that's fine, but is that the only thing we're going to do? Where is bhakti hidden in your own tradition? Rediscovering the bhakti in Catholicism. Maybe we should be having a course like that. If that's what's going to be happening in 2029, is there still going to be a Catholic Church? But maybe it's going to be a Catholic Church that's rediscovered bhakti. So what becomes our role? What are we supposed to be doing? As an institution, as a society. And then I can look at, wow, what do I want to do? How do I fit in? Is there some way I could contribute to that? So we start from the big picture, the big vision, and then we go to our ISKCON society, and then we go to the individuals. What role could you have in that? How could you do it? What is the step you could take today? Maybe a little step, maybe it's just a millimeter step, but is there a step you could take today to try to having that, bringing that vision come to reality in society 10 years from now? So we go from being in 10 years in the future and then coming back to here and now. Okay, where am I now? How do I get from here to there? And then, of course, we'll adjust it. As the 10 years go by and we're doing it, then periodically we're going to sit down and do visioning again and saying, okay, how am I proceeding on that? And am I going in that direction? And I'm convinced that if we were to do that, our members would be very enlivened to chant their 16 rounds and read Prabhupada's books and follow the principles and serve the deities. Because it's part of something, not just maintaining a building. Not just hoping, like, you know, I was walking around the property today, Krishna, please send some millionaire to donate for this place. Mm-hmm. But it's not just that anymore, which is kind of depressing if that's all it is. Yeah? So that's my own feeling. And there's at least one other devotee who's very much interested in this, and that's Bhakti Vasayan Sagar Maharaj. So he is very much talking about having visioning for society and training devotees or semi-devotees to go out in the world and take positions in the world in Krishna consciousness and set an example for the world in Krishna consciousness. So he has a whole institute in Mayapur to train people for this purpose, to train people who are already in those positions to learn how to be Krishna conscious leaders and to train people who are already devotees to go out in the world and be Krishna conscious leaders. So I didn't plan going in this direction in this class, or I would have ended my class earlier. My apologies. I would have ended it 8:20 instead of at 8:45. But this is something very much needed. And imagine if this could be done just in your manna, like the manna that came down in the desert for the Israelites. If you could do this in Fermanagh County, if you could just even do it in Fermanagh County, imagine that.
But we seem to be regressing that, actually, because we did do it. Like, I managed an organization here for years. We were on the Interfaith Council. They invited us to things, and we just stopped going. And I trained most of the community groups in this county.
What's your name?
Anandamaya.
Anandamaya?
Anandamaya. I train most of the community groups in this county, and yes, they...
May I ask? You don't have to answer. How old are you?
I'm 59.
Hurry up.
But, you know, when you try to do that within our own community, it's kind of like, you know, pretty much shut down. But we did that. Shurupa came into events.
Well, if we've done it, we can do it again. And let's do it again intelligently this time, where we really inspire the devotees with the proper vision. You're obviously a leader. That's very obvious. So take that and do what you can. And all each of us has to do is what we can. That's okay. But go for it. And if you started it before, it can be done again. But it has to be coupled with this vision of a society for the devotees. Otherwise, people don't see what the point is. Anutama tells me this all the time, that, you know, other GBC will say, why do you bother with this interfaith stuff? You know, and I taught at the GBC college, and I did this visioning exercise, and when I asked them the question, this was in India, and I said, let's say that this state of India, or all of India, where Mahaprabhu's movement what would be the situation of religions? And one of the people said there would only be ISKCON. And I thought, this is a gentleman who's never studied history. As soon as you have only one state-sponsored religious group, what do you always have that comes along with that?
Dictatorship.
A dictatorship? What else?
Corruption.
Hmm?
Corruption.
Corruption? What else?
Collapse.
Eventually collapse. How does a one state-sponsored religion that does not allow any other religions to exist, how does it maintain its hegemony? There's only one way. If you say that there's only one religion, only one church that is allowed to exist in a country that is state-sponsored, huh?
Persecution.
Persecution and torture. It's the only way. So if we're going to say that in an ideal society, ISKCON is the only religious organization and it's state-sponsored and no other religious organizations are allowed to exist, we are aiming for persecution and torture because that's how it works. Now, you can have an official religion that's tolerant of other religions. That's possible, but even that's a little sketchy. And if we look at parts of the world where that goes on, you know, there's still a lot of persecution happening. You know, it's as if we look at, say, Muslim governments where they sort of kind of a little bit tolerate other religions, maybe sort of. We still see a lot of persecution and we still see a lot of imprisonment. So is that the vision? I don't want to go there, sorry, that's not my interest. And, you know, the first time I met Srila Prabhupada, he was speaking to my father about that any religion is bona fide if it teaches you to know and love God. So if our vision for society is that there's still going to be many religions, if that's our vision for society, that we're not going to be the only Gaudiya Vaishnava group on the planet, that we're not going to be the only Vaishnava group on the planet, that the four Sampradayas will still continue to exist, that even, you know, the Vedic-based religion is not going to be the only religion, then how are these different religions going to transform such that Mahaprabhu's movement is going to be flooding the world? If they're still going to exist, and Mahaprabhu's movement is flooding the world, what does that mean? That's the question to be asking ourselves. And I would suggest that what that means is that these different faiths rediscover that bhakti is the root of their own religion, which it is. And they rediscover bhakti in their own way. They can be bhakti in a Catholic way, or an Eastern Orthodox way, or a Presbyterian way, or a Sunni way, or a Shiite way, or a Jewish way. I mean, they most certainly can. And who's going to help them do this? Isn't this our job? Isn't this what we're charged to do? Not just to have interfaith things that I like you and you like me and, well, hello there. You know, and I've seen that too. And okay, that maybe has some modicum of value. But if I can be the catalyst to help somebody in these other faiths discover within their own faith, they don't have to give up their faith. How many times did Prabhupada say that? But what is your faith? Is your faith really about having a nice house in the world and then going to heaven and having a barbecue with your family in heaven? Is that really what your faith is about? Going to heaven and being gifted 72 virgins? How did they end up in heaven? I don't know, you know. That didn't sound very heavenly for them. So, you know, is that what your faith is about? Or is your faith about love? Is your faith about full surrender? Is your faith about love? Is your faith about selfless service? Well, yes, it is. And that's our vision and that's our mission. Now, how we do that, that's how we take the steps there, obviously, it has to be with respect, with mutual respect. But if we have that vision, then the society isn't going to say, what's the use of your doing this? Why are you spending your time and energy on interfaith? Why are you spending your time and energy decorating somebody's hair? We're not going to get that from our own people. And yes, our own group is the biggest, you know, ice bucket throwers on the... We're really good at it, you know. I think we've like kind of perfected it to an art. Oh, you're doing something wonderful for Lord Chaitanya's movement. Well, take this. I'm a little cold now. You know, we're really good at that.
Yes, it's pretty authoritarian. I find that if there's new ideas, they're being just completely, very often just completely flattened.
Well, therefore, again, we need to have a vision. New ideas are going to be completely flattened if our idea is we're an insular monastic organization with one very rigid way of doing things, and everything else is garbage. So if that's our vision, if our idea, which doesn't make the slightest bit of sense, by the way. So if our vision is I'm going out to preach to people and everybody should come move here and live in the temple. Does that make any sense? In Fermanagh County, could we get everybody to move to the island? It would be a little troublesome. But if that's our idea, if that's how we're measuring our success, then we're going to squash anything that isn't in that little tiny place. So it's, you know, and I think people are very well-meaning. I think, you know, people who are very authoritarian and like that, I think they're meaning well, but their vision is a little peculiar. And they haven't really sat down and thought about their vision. They just haven't, they haven't articulated it. You know, they haven't, if you say to them, well, what is your, you know, is this your vision? They'd say, well, no. And, well, what is your vision? And they're not really very clear about it. So people tend to act that way when they don't know where they're going. It's not really their fault in a sense. Yeah.
There's just two things come to mind that you're saying. One I remember is that those Nectar of Devotion series Prabhupada made. And they're in Vrindavan, and he's actually saying in those lectures that I never came to the Western countries to make Hindus out of everybody. And it's interesting, it just proves what you're saying, because he said it in Vrindavan talking to the devotees. It wasn't a kind of a thing to the public in the West. It was actually in Vrindavan. So,
that's interesting you're saying that, because I spent, in the last couple of years, I decided that I'd listen to Prabhupada's Bhagavatam classes over and over again. And I realized I hadn't listened to the Nectar Devotion classes over and over again, probably once or twice. So I started listening. There's not that many of them, so you can listen to them over and over and over and over again in a short period of time. So, yeah.
And the other one was when it was in, I read it, I think, in Hari Sariprabhu's diary when there was, the devotees were starting up the Gurukul in Vrindavan. And they were excited, and they said, Prabhupada, we can get all the ISKCON devotees to come from America and from England and from Europe. And Prabhupada said, this is what he said, ISKCON,
FISKCON, yeah.
Just fill up the school with children. You know, it kind of cuts out this thing that it's ISKCON that's going to be.
Yes. Yeah, well, when we met with Prabhupada in 1974, and my father said, is it okay if I come to the temple even though I'm Jewish? I have my own religion. I'm not coming to worship Krishna. I said, yes. Prabhupada was in a very jolly, casual mood. He was leaning back and his foot up like this. And you could see his leg and his foot. He said, yes. He said, just like we are in Chicago, he said, and there are many planes going to Chicago. He said, but they have to know they're going to Chicago, or there's no meaning to many planes. He said, so there are many religions if they are trying to know God and to love him. And I mean, for me personally, one of the reasons that I became Srila Prabhupada's disciple and one of the reasons that I joined ISKCON is that Prabhupada consistently had a non-sectarian view. Consistently. If Srila Prabhupada had ever said, we're the only way and we have a monopoly on the truth, and, you know, I wouldn't have come. I was actually repulsed by that kind of thinking. And when I hear devotees speak like that, there's always something in me that goes kind of like, yeah. You know, it just strikes me as like a football game or something. You know, my team is the best team, or nationalism, and I find it very unpalatable. And it's not real. You know, how is it real? So I fully give myself permission to feel that, you know, that ISKCON is the best spiritual organization with the best philosophy on the planet. I give myself full permission to feel that way. Because otherwise, why would I be here? Then I would be someplace else. You know, if I thought that I could attain Krishna Prema in the Catholic Church, I'd be there if I thought that was superior. But also, I realized that objectively, one can attain Krishna prema through many different religions. That to say we have a monopoly on Krishna prema is absurd. I give it the example, like, you know, you should think that your husband is the best possible husband for you. But that probably isn't true. You know, you really haven't examined every single male on the planet to decide that this particular man is the best possible man that you could be married to. But nor should you, you know. Do you follow what I'm saying? You know, but if you start believing that, so if you say, yes, my husband is he's the best husband. Absolutely. There's no better husband on the planet. That's very good. But if you believe that that's an objective fact, you start running into some kind of problems. So I don't believe it's an objective fact. But I kind of do, but I don't. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You know, there is a part of me that believes that that's an objective fact, that Srila Prabhupada is the best guru, and that ISKCON is the best organization, and the Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy is the best philosophy. There's a big part of me that literally believes that that's an objective fact. And then there's another part of me that goes, I don't really know if it's an objective fact or not, and I really don't care, because I'm completely happy and satisfied. But because I know it may not be an objective fact, I'm fine with someone saying, hey, I want to stay a Christian and attain Krishna prema. Can I do that? And I'd go, sure, why not? And I could believe that, and it wouldn't be like saying, sure, why not? But actually, you're really an idiot, and I don't think you should be doing that, and you're really second class, and that's really, you know, maybe someday you'll become actually serious and join my group. You know? Is that what's going on? Oh, yes, 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 you can find bhakti in Islam, but not really. Not if you were actually sincere. You're not sincere. If that's my little subtext going on.
But isn't that where all the world's religious conflict comes from?
It absolutely.
The persecution of others.
Well, not all, but a lot of it, yes.
Yeah, because they feel that theirs is the only way, it's my way or not.
Yes. And what mode of nature is that bhakti in? Lord Kapila Dev talks about bhakti in the modes. What mode is that? Ignorance. That's bhakti in the mode of ignorance. And what level of, in the 11th canto of Kanista Majjhima Uttama, what level is that? Kanista, where you think God's only in my temple. So that means God's only in the temple in two ways. First of all, it means God's only in the temple and not in my hair salon. When I paint a picture of Krishna in the temple, God is there. When I cut someone's hair in my hair salon, God's not there. God is only in the temple. This is the only place I can be spiritual. And it also means God's only in my temple. He's not in your temple.
That's a paradox of what Krishna just says about the people.
Yes. So, you know, God is only in the Sunni Muslim mosque. He's not in the Shiite Muslim mosque. He's only in the Catholic Church. He's not in the Protestant churches. And you all know that we literally kill each other over this. I don't have to tell you guys that. Mm-hmm. Yeah? In the same religion! I mean, oh my God! I mean, okay, Muslims and Jews, all right, but Catholics and Protestants? Sunnis and Shiites? Seriously? And then we're going to go to the world and say, we have the absolute truth. And people are going to look at you and say, no, thank you. If you're going to take out your rifle and shoot somebody who worships your same God in a slightly different way. You know, it's like, it's Kanista. And Prabhupada over and over again said, come to the Majjhima platform. Okay, I'm a Kanista today. Okay, fine. Move ahead. Don't stay Kanista. The Kanistas are also called Prakrita Bhaktis, which literally means materialistic devotees. So the question is raised, why call such people devotees at all? And Bhaktivinoda gives the answer. He says, well, the real devotees, they're supposed to just associate with devotees. They're supposed to avoid materialistic people. So by calling these people Prakriti Bhaktas, they become fit to associate with the higher devotees. So the advanced devotees say, okay, we can associate with you as a devotee because you're a Prakriti Bhakta. But it's basically materialistic. And there's one place where Prabhupada says, chanting Hare Krishna in that mood gives you simply material pains and pleasures. So, you know, we're supposed to come to the Majjhima Plan. And in Raghunath Das Goswami's Manashiksha, which Krishna allowed me to produce and teach, and I'm sorry, I don't have any more copies here, I sold them all in Dublin. But the Raghunath Das Goswami says we should have love for all the devotees, and Bhaktivinoda said that's three categories: those who always live in Vrindavan, at least in their consciousness, sincere practitioners of any tradition who may not live in Vrindavan because they don't have a concept of Vrindavan, and ordinary religious leaders who teach ordinary morals and ethics. That those three categories of devotees, one should have unprecedented and excessive love for them, not just respect, not just interfaith respect. But Raghunath Das Goswami in verse 1, and it's a padati, it's a step-by-step guide, in verse 1, unprecedented and excessive love. As I once saw a sign at a Christian education convention, everyone who loves Jesus should love everyone who loves Jesus. You know, everyone who loves God should love everyone who loves God. Actual love. You know, and deep love and deep appreciation. And not just, you know, some sectarianism. At the same time, we can think that our process is the best. That's okay. Otherwise, why am I here? If I don't think my process is the best, then I'm not really organizing my own life very well. So, you know, that's fine. Even in the spiritual world, everyone thinks their rasa is the best. The cowherd boys, like, they don't want to be gopis. They say, oh, those gopis, they just cry all the time. They're not interested. And the flower wants to be a flower. The flower is thinking, I have the best rasa. I get to be in Krishna's hand all day. I get to follow Krishna from the village to the forest. Whereas the parents, they stay in the village and cry. When we come back from the forest, the deer are crying, and I get to be with Krishna all the time. So I have the best rasa. That's not true. The residents of Vaikuntha, they think, like we were studying last night, they think, yes, I worship the supreme form of God. In majesty and opulence, I worship the most godly form of God. If you want to worship some intimate cowherd boy form, okay, that's fine. We have the most godly God. That's it. All right, we should take prasadam, yes? Bye.